Lord Chair. We're again picking up House Bill number 182, the Rules Committee by request of the Governor, an act relating to the disposition of unclaimed property, providing for an effective date. This is the second time that we've had this bill before us, and I didn't check the sign-in over there, but could I get some indication if there's anybody here that anticipates right now wanting to testify on this bill, other than the Strip Snack? Okay, that's great. Mr. Epstein, why don't you just run this table up here, if you would?
Thank you.
And we really appreciate your flying up and joining us today. And I hastened to add on the floor of the House the other day, not at Alaska State expense, during the years of the declining revenues, but at the expense of the national organization, the Uniform Laws, I guess.
That's correct.
And if you would, Mr. Epstein, just give us an overview of this bill, in particular, your experience with these types of bills in the states that have adopted them, what can be accomplished in the way of additional revenues for the state, and more importantly, even revenues for the people who apparently have mistakenly abandoned monies and would otherwise not receive it. I think both of those are really goals. For the record, if you identify yourself.
Yes, my name is David J. Epstein. I'm a attorney who practices in Los Angeles, California. For the last several years, I've served as a consultant on unclaimed property matters to 37 states. I've helped them set up their programs and train their auditors. I've also authored a book on unclaimed property law. I can report that it's not on the bestseller list. In connection with the bill that you have under review today, I participated as a co-author of that bill and worked with the drafting committee in connection with its preparation. Unclaimed property laws represent an interesting opportunity for government to assist its residents in locating and identifying unclaimed intangible property that people have lost or forgotten about. And let me explain what's involved. What we're talking about is not snowshoes and lost overcoats. We're talking about uncashed payroll checks and unclaimed checking and savings accounts. We're talking about gift certificates that perhaps you received and were thrown out with the Christmas wrappings. We're talking about credit balances that you may have with the department store. We're talking about insurance proceeds that perhaps your spouse died and you were unaware that they had a small policy from years ago and the company's never been advised of your death and they do not know whom to pay. It's amazing how much money can be lost. Each year the states are collecting almost $250 million in abandoned property. It's estimated right now that there's probably $750 million that the states are holding for a return to their residents. The kind of law that you're dealing with is called a custodial law, and this point is very important. The state becomes the trustee of the property. It takes custody of the property until the lawful owner can be located. In most of the states, with short abandonment periods, are able to locate as much as 50% of the missing owners. And in fact, that's what's happening in Alaska right now with regard to savings accounts and checking accounts. I don't think it's well known, but you've had on the books for a substantial period of time a law that requires your savings and loans and your banks to turn over checking accounts and savings accounts if the customer has not had any activity in the account for a period of 7 years. When the state receives the report of this property, an independent search is made by the Office of the Attorney General. And by using various records that are available to the state, including vital statistics and driver's license information and vehicle registration information, they have been able to locate what appears to be almost half of the missing owners. So what's being suggested in this bill is that the approach that the state has taken in connection with checking and savings accounts be extended to the hundreds of other types of property which an owner may lose or forget about. Now, I had an interesting experience in this area, which I want to relate to you because I think it'll demonstrate that even the most attentive of us can lose their property. I think that you had a chance to view a tape earlier today that indicated that Bob Hope lost $7,000 in money. Lucille Ball lost a savings account. The former governor of California, Governor Brown, lost a savings account. That's true for the former governor of Minnesota. And your witness, David Epstein, also lost a share of stock. And the way it happened, I think, best demonstrates why these laws are required. I had moved my law office and left a forwarding address where my office was going to be located, and the post office carried that for 1 year, and after that point in time, they no longer forward mail. Thereafter, a company in which I owned one share of stock declared a stock split, and I was entitled to another share of stock, and they'd attempted to send it out, and it came back undeliverable. And like most of us, I wasn't following the Wall Street Journal every day to make sure that this company owed me any stock. And lo and behold, one day I hear from a friend of mine that my name has been advertised in the LA Times as someone who's entitled to some lost property. And I contacted the state of California, and I was able to get back my stock. Now, this happens every day. In Massachusetts, for example, they are holding property for 1 out of every 5 of their citizens. And down in California, I suspect that it's probably in the neighborhood of 1 out of every 10 or 20 people. And I think that in Alaska, that you would find even a higher rate. And the reason for this is with people moving in and out of Alaska, there's a tendency for there to be a much higher rate of abandoned property. And based on the reports that I have seen that were filed with the Attorney General's office by the banks, there was a very, very high rate of abandoned property being reported, which suggested to me that you have a high rate of turnover of people coming and going, and for a variety of reasons, they don't recall that they had property on hand. Now, every state but your state and Wyoming and Colorado have comprehensive unclaimed property laws. The origin of this law is back in feudal times. Under the common law, you can guess who was entitled to all abandoned property. Needless to say, it was the king. And it was the old and venerable doctrine of bona vacantia. And since that time, the states have refined the concept considerably. Pennsylvania, back in the late 1700s, adopted the first unclaimed property law. And you can go to the Pennsylvania Unclaimed Property Office today, and they still have the handwritten ledgers that they kept of all the property that had been turned over. And in that time, it also included personal property like a desk and a cow and perhaps some miscellaneous cash. Around the turn of the century, in the early 1900s, a variety of states started to adopt unclaimed property laws that applied to checking and savings accounts. By the 1930s, most states had that kind of law in place, and they were starting to adopt laws that related to insurance policies. When a person died, and people were unaware that they were entitled to receive any of that property. The first major step was in 1954, when the Uniform Law Commission promulgated the Uniform Disposition of Unclaimed Property Act, which is the forerunner of the act that you're considering. Since that time, most of the states either adopted that act or they adopted their own version of an unclaimed property law. Considerable dissatisfaction grew with the 1954 act because of the problems that holders were having in complying with its terms and the problems that the states were having in obtaining compliance. And back around 1979, the states got together and asked the Uniform Law Commission to update the act. And this act is a result of that. Now, the act represents a series of compromises that were entered into between the unclaimed property administrators and the various state interests and the holders. And throughout the act, those compromises appear. The drafting committee was assisted with representatives from the utility industry, from the security industry, from banking and savings and loan, from the credit unions, from the money order industry. All of those groups were represented and served either in a formal advisor capacity or appeared and presented evidence at the various meetings of the Uniform Law Commission. In drafting the act, the drafting committee was guided by those two very famous drafting principles. One now described as the chicken soup principle, which is a little bit, it won't hurt you, And the other principle was what I call the handyman principle, which is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And hopefully throughout the act you will see evidence of this. And what the committee intended to do was to come up with a modernization and an updating of the unclaimed property laws. Now, the beginning point for unclaimed property is which state is entitled to receive the property. And up until 1965, there was in effect a race of diligence among the states as to which one would claim property first. And the Supreme Court had come up with a whole series of conflicting cases, which in some cases allowed the state of incorporation to claim all the property. In other cases, it allowed the state of last known address of the owner to claim the property. And then there was variations on this thing. In 1965, in a case called Texas versus New Jersey, the Supreme Court attempted to set down rules that would determine which state could claim. And these rules are important to Alaska, and I'll indicate why. The basic rule is the property goes to the state of last known address of the owner. So the corporation looks at its records, and if it has an address for that owner, it might be somebody who received a dividend check, they know where they mailed it. In the case of a bank, it's normally going to be within the state where the bank's located, but not always. In the case of a payroll check, they should have a location for the person. In the case of an insurance company, it would be the last known address of the insurer. That's a basic rule. Now, there's some variations on this thing. Suppose the state of last known address does not have a law that covers the property, and that's your situation. Alaska, on all the various types of property except for savings accounts and checking accounts, has no law. In that case, the property goes to the state of incorporation. Therefore, over the years, property owing to Alaskans, unclaimed dividend checks, wage checks, you name it, the corporations have held have been reported the state they're incorporated in. Your property is scattered all over the country. So I think it's important to note that if you were not to adopt this law, what will happen is your property will continue being claimed by other states. So you really have no option here. If you don't adopt the law, it's a decision that the property is going to go to the other states. Now, the Supreme Court anticipated this situation, and they said, at such time as you do adopt a law, then you can reclaim the property from the other states. So you don't lose it permanently. However, it's scattered all over the place. And sometimes the records are not kept in a condition that permit you to quickly find out what you're entitled to. That being the case, it behooves you to get into place your own unclaimed property law in the same manner that all these other states have. The last situation is if there is no last known address on the property, and that can arise. Sometimes the records are old, they get discarded, insurance companies may have a list of their outstanding checks, but they don't have the names and the addresses of the people entitled to that property. And in that case, it goes to your state of incorporation. Now, the 1981 Uniform Act has been considered by several states and adopted by those states, and I wanted to indicate those because I thought it would be useful. The following states have adopted this act: Arizona, Hawaii, Idaho, Washington, Wisconsin, and Utah. The District of Columbia has a version of this act. It was based on one of our drafts. There's a bill now pending in the state of New Hampshire, which would adopt this act. In addition, about another 15 or 20 states have taken certain provisions out of this act and put it into their 1954 Unclaimed Property Act. So there's been widespread acceptance of the act. I thought what might be useful would be for me to run through some of the major provisions of the act, and as we're dealing with each one, if there's questions, why don't we handle them at that time.
Before we get started with that, just some basic on insurance. How does an insurance company ever find out that it's unclaimed, because people claim insurance? So
let me describe how that works.
Yeah, I'd be curious.
In the case of an insurance policy, which we describe a whole life policy, generally you pay dividends until about, I think, age 65. let's assume you paid the policy up, and now you don't have to pay any longer, and thank goodness you're well, and you live several more years, and then you die, and your heirs, your spouse, whomever, do not discover the policy of insurance, and it happens all the time. And there's no central place to go and find out if you're entitled to claim as a beneficiary. That information generally is not kept. The property would be held permanently by the insurance company. And that was a situation in a U.S. Supreme Court case involving the Connecticut General Mutual Life Insurance Company. And New York had passed a law, which is really the forerunner of what's in the 81 Act, and it said that if at the time the person reaches the limiting age under the policy, and that's a very technical term for saying approximately age 96, on a whole life policy...
That's a limiting age.
Yeah, that's very limiting, all right. If you still have, if you're still alive at age 96 under the policy, you're entitled to go in and get an annuity or an endowment. And so what the state of New York did was it passed a law. It says if you the person has reached that age, according to your books, and they haven't appeared, then 7 more years after that, that's 103, the insurance company must report the property to the state. Now, that is the only way that a beneficiary would find out, because the state would then advertise the name of the insured, and in a large percentage of the cases, some relative or heir might come forward and then make a claim. And that is the only thing that keeps that policy from becoming the sole property of the insurance company. And if were it not for this law, the insurance company would hold that money indefinitely. And the Supreme Court, in this case that I described, said, wait a second, it was never intended that this money not be paid over. But there is a more serious situation. You're probably all familiar with it. If you miss a dividend payment on certain policies, the insurance company will give you a notice, and they'll say there's some cash surrender value in your policy, and we'll pay your premium with the money that's in the policy. Or in some cases, they will buy you a new kind of insurance. It's called a term insurance policy. Now, they will continue using the cash surrender value to pay the premiums until it's completely exhausted. Suppose the reason you're not paying the premiums is you died. Your policy will be entirely consumed well before the time you would reach the limiting age. There are some provisions in the 81 Act that are directed at getting at that situation. We couldn't completely solve the issue for this reason. In probably 99% of the cases, it's very important that the cash surrender value be used to pay the next premium. Otherwise, you'll lose your insurance, and in 99% of the cases, the person's alive, and that's what they intend. But that 1% of the cases, it's very difficult. It hasn't been solved yet. The provisions in here that relate to the company giving notice that an automatic premium loan provision is being used and updating the policy to get addresses of the beneficiaries are very important. They're intended to start to get at this issue. And the last thing that the bill attempts to do is there was a practice with some insurance companies. It wasn't necessarily widespread, but with some insurance companies, even though they knew of the death of the insured and they had the names of the beneficiaries, they didn't contact the beneficiaries. They sat back and waited to see if a claim would be filed. Well, of course it wouldn't be. The beneficiaries didn't know that there was a policy. This law will take care of that situation. It requires that the company take an affirmative step if it's aware of the death of the insured. But again, I want to emphasize that was not a terribly widespread practice, but it had occurred. What the unclaimed property bill does is it tries to fine-tune its provisions to handle each one of the unique situations that can arise with any particular holder of property. I think that the insurance section that I just described is a good example. They put in all kinds of provisions that are really fine-tuned and related to just how the insurance industry operates. Banking is another good example. I think this bill should not be of considerable interest to the banking community. They're already on board and reporting abandoned property. And most types of abandoned property are coming in. I think this will have very little impact on the banks. And it looks like they're probably doing a pretty good job right now.
Excuse me, you're making that decision on the basis of the inquiry you've already made and looked at the Alaska situation.
Yes, I had an opportunity to review the records that were filed with the Attorney General's office. I've spoken with the person who runs that program, Jean Wingate, and she is to be complimented. She has one of the most efficient operations, which she's handling with 10% of her time that I've seen. She's single-handedly returning all this property. And the banks, fairly recently, have been doing a good job in reporting the property over. And I don't think this bill will have much effect at all on the banks, but it does do some things that are good for the bank in this regard. It sets forth the criteria for when you will presume abandonment in a more precise fashion than it is done right now. The terms of the banking escheat statute are somewhat vague. Excuse me. What this will do is it will say, look, if you have an inactive checking account, but the person has an active savings account, don't presume it abandoned. That's not in the law right now, but common sense would suggest that you ought to do it. Suppose a person has an inactive savings account and has an active credit card, and you know where the person is. Don't presume the account abandoned. And what it does is it provides for cross-referencing. So if the bank has in its records information that the person's whereabouts is otherwise known, all I have to do is drop them a little note saying, this is to remind you, you have an inactive savings account with us. And the property is not to be reported to the state. The Act does something else that's very important. Suppose you have what we call a term CD, and I think people are familiar with that. You go out and open an account that will be held for 2, 3, or 4 years. In many cases, these accounts are continually rolled over. They are renewed. You need an unclaimed property law here because in some cases, they're automatically renewable without the customer doing anything. What it would mean is if the customer died and the heirs did not know anything about this account, it would go on indefinitely. And in fact, down in Montana a few years ago when I was working down there, we found a situation at a bank where the bank employee had died, her estate had been probated, and what was left out was this certificate of deposit that kept rolling over. Here we are 10 years later after the probate. It was only because we were working with the bank and using the unclaimed property laws that the situation was identified. And it was very interesting. They located the owner through considerable effort, by the owner I mean the heirs, and the heir, it was almost like a lottery situation. The heir received a phone call from Montana and had to provide her social security number to see if she were the right person. She read it off and she had $10,000 coming. She was so excited, it was unbelievable. It was only through this law that would have happened. This law now provides clarity. It says, if you have a CD that rolls over and if you make a telephone contact with the person, they ask to renew it, it's not presumed abandoned, and that goes on indefinitely. As long as there's a contact every 5 years, that's all that's required. Let's assume you lose contact, you can't reach the person, and they go 5 years without cashing any interest, without increasing the balance of it, without having another account with the bank, without having a loan with the bank. In other words, they're lost. Only then would it be reported, and if it would happen that at the time of the report, it would result in an interest penalty because the most recent term hadn't expired. This Act says don't turn the property over if there's going to be any interest penalty. Wait until the time period is up. So the Act has been designed to take care of each factual situation the best it can, consistent with getting property back to missing owners and allowing the state to hold it, yet not claiming property that shouldn't be presumed abandoned. The Act's also divided into sections that deal with property that might be held by a business. Here is a good example. Years and years ago, somebody owned certificate number 3 of the Texas Land Pacific Company. Now, very few of you probably recognize the name of that company, but that's now Texaco. And that certificate in 1978, not today, but 1978, was worth $3 million. It had been lost. It sat on the books of Texaco all this time. Nobody knew anything about it. In 1978, they were going through the basement of the Wells Fargo Bank in San Francisco, and they found the certificate. there then ensued the biggest brouhaha between the two warring branches of the family over who was going to be entitled to this. And in that case, they could establish who would become the owner. But in most cases, there's no procedure for a corporation that has records of people entitled to stock, and presumably they're holding the certificate, but they're not cashing dividends, they can't find them for any purpose. That property's just building up on the books of the company. The stock is is of no value to the company. They could care less whether it's registered in the name of X or the state of Alaska. What this law does is it says that if you can't find the person for 7 years, and if they have failed to cash at least 7 dividend checks, then you cancel the outstanding stock certificate, you reissue it in the name of the state, and then the state will find it, follow its normal procedures in trying to locate you. There are now 34 states that are working together in making it easy for corporations to report this kind of abandoned property, and the results are very substantial. And we think that this could represent a significant amount of property for Alaska to return to its residents, and failing that, to hold the property until such time they can be found. And if they can never be found, you'll have the permanent use of the property. I want to emphasize something. The rightful owner or their heirs can come forward at any time to claim the property. There is no statute of limitations on the missing owner's right to get the property. And that requires that you set up permanent records, and in effect, the state becomes the owner of last resort. And if somebody wants to come in 60, 70 years from now to check your records, to see if they have anything coming, you're supposed to maintain those records. Now, in days of modern record keeping, it is not a big job. For virtually pennies an account, you can set it up, have it on a computer for a while. Later on, microfiche it and just file it and store millions of names in just a few filing cabinet drawers and have a permanent record of that. What's good about it is it relieves the corporations and the banks and the other holders of the obligation of maintaining these records. And that can be expensive. And in certain cases, if the property is not subject to a statute of limitations, theoretically a bank or a savings and loan or a credit union would be required to keep a permanent record of this property forever. There's nothing that would relieve them of that obligation. It's only the unclaimed property law that comes in and substitutes the state in place of the bank, and requires that the state pay the obligation. And the banks can just wipe their hands of the property. And it allows other corporations to get rid of these old records and the old property. I understand there may be a question raised later on regarding certain other record-keeping obligations. I'd be more than happy to address that. In addition to the property held by insurance companies and banks and the stock and dividends held by business associations, you have property held by utilities, and this happens all the time, where you place a deposit for utility service, and then you move away, and you forget about it, and perhaps some efforts made to locate you, or at least to send it to your last known address, but you've moved on to other parts, you didn't leave a forwarding address, or the post office, which is not terribly successful, is unable to forward this, your property would be lost otherwise. There may be even refunds to be paid by utilities. Suppose there's been some type of rate rebate or some adjustment in the pricing scheme. Right now, under your law, this property is just going to the utility. They're keeping it. And perhaps the statute of limitations is running on the property. And so after 6 years, nobody can claim the property. Well, it was never contemplated at the time the parties entered into this relationship that it would be kept permanently by the utility. It was supposed to be security, so that if you didn't pay your bill, they could look to it, but if you did pay your bill, they weren't supposed to keep the property. This law takes care of this situation and provides a short time period. After 1 year, they have to send the property on. Now, this is for good reason. Nobody in their right mind would let an account that's not drawing interest sit around for a long period of time. And so on a variety of types of property, we used a very short abandonment period. This really represents a compromise. I had argued very strenuously that I thought the general abandonment period should be very short, because there's no value to people leaving their money on deposit with a company in the form of a credit memo or credit balance or a utility deposit. The drafting committee wouldn't agree with that except in connection with specific types of property. The utility is one example. Another example is payroll checks. I mean, only somebody who had moved on and did not realize that they had perhaps a few days' pay coming or had failed to cash a payroll check for whatever reason, gotten lost in the shuffle, and that's what takes place. And the abandonment period is 1 year on payroll checks. And then we have some rather narrow interests that have been considered. One type of property is that represented by an IRA. And those are very popular these days, and some of them are, you know, $100, $200. Maybe they go up to the maximum of $2,000, and people are jumping in and out of different kinds of investments and changing institutions from year to year. And pretty soon you're going to find that somebody who started doing this when they were age 30 is going to have 15 or 20 different IRAs going on. And they're going to lose track of them. And they get an occasional notification, but they don't really have to pay attention to it because there's nothing for them to do generally. One of them may be at a bank just in a CD. You don't have to pay attention to it except to renew it. Others may be in the stock market. So what we're eventually going to find is they're going to be scattered all over the place. Now, people will lose track of them. And when they die, the heirs will have even greater difficulty determining where the IRAs were. Because if the trustee does not have a good mailing address, they won't be able to contact you. And the only way these will ever be identified is if you have an unclaimed property law in place. What this act has done, though, is taken care of the situation that there's no premature presumption of abandonment. What the law says is that only at the time a distribution would be mandatory, which could not be earlier than age 59 and a half, and might well be age 65. It's at that time you start presuming the abandonment, and then you go another 5 years before the property would have to be reported. And even then, the state would first advertise the name, and the person would have a substantial period of time to come forward to claim the property before it even be turned over. There's no risk that anyone can be harmed in this situation. Now, I've been moving along very quickly, and I haven't given any space here for questions. Why don't I stop for a minute and see if there's some areas you'd like to cover.
For the record, Mr. Taylor, Petty John, President. Mr. Winberg?
Yes, in this state, under the Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act, landlords are supposed to put security deposits into a trust account. Is that covered by this bill?
Unless there was some inconsistent provision in your Landlord-Tenant Act, it would be covered by the bill. It would be treated as miscellaneous intangible property under the general intangible section, and it would be abandoned 5 years after the person could have demanded the return of the deposit. It's important to note that if the landlord is entitled to claim damages out of that deposit, this wouldn't supersede that right. But whatever remained after the landlord rightfully took out of the deposit to cover themselves would be presumed abandoned under this act.
I may be getting slightly ahead, but if I may, Mr. Chairman, briefly, does this bill impose an obligation on such landlords 5 years later to transmit the money to the state?
I believe it would, unless there, and again, I haven't read your act, but I'm familiar with them in other states.
Assuming it says exactly what I said.
Okay. Yes, it would. And what the landlord would do is file a report, and the state would advertise the name of the missing owner, send the letter out, and take other steps to try and locate the person. And if they didn't, then the landlord would turn the property over to the state. And the state would set up a permanent record to hold that property.
Thank you.
Here in Alaska, we have an absolutely unique thing the lawyers are very fond of called the permanent fund dividend. I'm not sure you're familiar with it.
I've heard about it. In fact, I had some relatives move up here to take advantage of it.
I see. You could have gone all day without saying that. But I'm not sure that even applies, but I at least want to raise the question. I presume that even though those you file 1 year for the immediate 6 month period, and that establishes your record so you get it, I presume there's even a certain number of those that are eventually returned, you know, by the post office because the person is moved. So what would happen in those cases? The state, I guess, would just treat itself like just another
You know what you do? You'd shift pocketbooks. Yeah. That's basically what we're talking about. It's an accounting entry. The person's name would be advertised. If they don't respond, wherever you're now keeping those unpresented checks or warrants, you now shift the fund over, which may be the same fund. Mm-hmm. What it would do is it'd provide a mechanism for returning the property, a substantial portion of which, however, would remain with the state where it now is.
Mr. Pidgeon?
Now, when this property, wherever it's coming from, the state acquires it, advertises, sends letters, can't find the people or their heirs, then does it go into the general fund?
A certain amount is set aside to pay the claims as they come in. And I believe under your act, the balance is kept in the general fund. Normally what you'll find is that each year as more property comes in and you replenish your claim fund, you'll have more than enough money on hand. In effect, what the courts have said is that there's a continuing appropriation over the general fund to pay claims as they come in. And the states have found that the major claiming takes place as a result of their advertising. And what the state does is it advertises the name of the person contacts the state, and the state directs them on to the bank, the credit union, the corporation, and says, they're holding your property. And that's where the major claiming's done. And then after the time period has expired for the holder to pay off this person, then the holder files a final report sending in all the remaining unclaimed property to the state. And once you have the property, after you've done your advertising, you receive the property that hasn't been claimed, the claims at that point go way down. Sometimes the figures that are put out are apples and oranges, and you need to be wary. If you look only at what is later claimed, once the property has reached you, it's only going to be maybe 10 or 15%. You've got to add in what is claimed as a result of your advertising before the property has been sent to you. That's going to be, could be 35, 40%. And then what's left over is generally about 50%, which you will hold in the general fund for the benefit of all the taxpayers in Alaska.
What about this property that's, you know, like I go out and I find something on the street. Is that unclaimed property that got turned into the state?
Your unclaimed property law generally covers what we call intangible property, which is cash or stock, things like that.
Right.
If you find a piece of tangible property, like cash in the trunk of a car at an airport under very suspicious circumstances, and this is happening all the time. But there was a wonderful fight down in California between Avis and the next person who rented a car and some drug dealers and everybody else in town. And your law isn't going to cover that situation. I think what you'll find on the books is generally there's either local laws, like the local police department normally has laws covering finders of lost property. In some cases, states have laws in that regard. But this, the 1981 Uniform Unclaimed Property Act, the only tangible property it really deals with is the contents of safe deposit boxes. Other than that, this law would not affect how that would be disposed of. Quite frankly, I don't know the answer.
While you're here, I want to direct a question toward the Department of Revenue, if I could, just because. Am I reading, Commissioner Nordell's here, am I reading this correctly that there's a fiscal note of $2 million for cost? Or I'm having a hard time understanding this fiscal note. Yeah, okay.
It is going to figure out a cost.
Yeah,
we're talking about
60 million dollars for cost. Revenue is 2 million. That's right. Okay, so we don't have anything. Right. Probably is we never see one bill around here. Right. 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 was the first SGT, or whatever you would call it. Has there ever been any discussion as to why the state should receive 100% of the SGT funds rather than the local municipality? where the person was probably living, where the institution is located. Why the state 100%?
That's a good question. And I think you can divide divide this into two parts. For purposes of administration, you need to do it centrally. It's the only way your advertising will be effective. And for purposes of keeping a united house and all the housekeeping in order, you need to do it centrally. For purposes of how you allocate the funds, there's a variety of ways of doing this. Let me point out that in Wisconsin, the extra money is held in the state school fund, the interest of which is used to finance the construction of public school libraries. In Illinois, they hold it in the legislative retirement
fund. You could have gone without saying that.
Maybe we better stop the camera. I'm serious. They're very flexible. No amendments will be entertained. In Maryland, up until recently, they had a formula that divided the excess monies among the various counties. And each legislative session, they would amend what the allocation was going to be. And then there was provisions made, however, that if any money was needed to pay off any claims, then there'd be a pro rata return of the money, or the next distribution would be diminished in order to keep money on hand. So, for purposes of where you keep it in your books, I think it's wide open. The one thing you have to do, though, is agree to return it to the missing owner. And those are two different problems.
May I just continue?
I
assume you were serious about what you said in Illinois.
I was very serious.
With respect to, for example, the Maryland approach, or any of these, are they contained in their versions of, I don't recall any of those states being among those you mentioned under the 1981 Act.
Maryland has adopted about six or seven of the key provisions from the 81 Act. However, their section that deals with what do you do with the money that's not needed to pay claims,
that's
unto its own. If you'd like to see a copy of that, I can have my office send it to you.
I would very much. I would like to see how any of these other states have approached the allocation issue, because I think that that's something that we should be concerned with.
We have a dedication of funds for a division, too. I think the dedication has almost best doing the general fund.
Well, I mean, I could foresee a situation where the legislation would say that the money from, let's say it's held in an institution, 90% of it would go a check from the institution to the state, and the other 10% directly from the institution to the municipality, so it would never pass into the state.
Well, that'd be a little bit different now if you did it that way. It'd be a nightmare to administer the program. You'd never be able to keep your books straight between what went where. A very, very difficult situation. Ohio has a unique situation. Part of it is kept with, the holder is allowed to reinvest in a savings account, and the balance goes to the state, and trying to keep this reconciled is very, very difficult.
If you can have your staff send that to me, I won't take your time now, and then your question, obviously.
Mr. Taylor.
going to be held apparently in perpetuity should be deposited into the permanent fund.
How are you
going to
get it out?
You only put enough in to let you know that you're not going to draw on that. You can always continue to
refill. Suppose somebody comes in that in the future is a large sum of money, like millions. I have to confess, I'm not familiar with what you mean by the permanent fund.
That's a great idea. I think we could work out the details.
Yeah.
My thought is because it's being held in perpetuity, that's the only thing that we have is constitutional mandate. And with some degree of security, and as a consequence, that would seem to be a more fitting depository for it. But we do have rules and laws concerning real property that's abandoned, or that real property, even whether abandoned or not, cannot violate the rule against perpetuity, in that it cannot be held forever, and go unused, and that's based on a whole lot of reasons. Because of the value of land and the need for expansion or construction of various projects and so on. I guess I have a hard time understanding why there shouldn't eventually be some termination date at which time those funds, just like land, would be required to be rolled back into the economy as opposed to being sequestered away from the economy and held literally forever awaiting someone to come forward.
Let me clarify something. The obligation of the state is in the absence of having gone to court and obtained a court order of escheat is that the state agree to pay a missing owner. The state does not literally have to sequester the money and set it aside. It's sufficient if the state, under state law, is required to honor all the claims. You can spend the money any way you want. It's fungible. You put it in most states, I'd say all but a handful, put it in their general fund and they spend it every year. They set a little bit aside to pay claims as they come up. There's nothing beyond that are you required to do. One case actually considered that, and they said, look, the state under its general taxing power can raise any money needed to pay off the claims of missing owners. So as long as you leave on hand enough just to pay present claims, you can spend that money, in effect, because everybody knows that the owners of a certain portion of it are never going to come forward. What you eventually could do, if you want to get rid of your old records, and there's only one reason to do this, if after some period of time it seems like nobody's going to come forward and you want to get rid of those records, what you'd have to do for due process purposes is go to court. And the way you are now doing it with the bank accounts, this is a monstrous job, and the notification you have to give is very stringent, and I think you'd be wasting money engaging in that exercise. And none of the states do that at this point. And while some of the states put in their law, yes, we may go ahead subsequently and escheat the law by attempting to give notice and publishing and going to court and having the judge rule that nobody's come forward and the state can take title. Very few do that anymore. On real property, I believe it's a different matter because you need to have the permanence of ownership and you need to follow true escheat proceedings in that area.
I appreciate that explanation. Thank you. I had another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know what the chair's plan is today on the bill, but there are quite a number of people here. I just wondered, through the chair, if there were any people here that intended to speak in opposition.
Earlier I asked, and at that point at least, nobody indicated that they wanted to testify on the bill. I'll ask the question again, perhaps in view of the testimony we've heard. Is there anybody that does plan on asking to be heard? Apparently not.
Wait a minute.
Not to be heard, but after all the committee's done, we might want to ask one question.
If I'm hearing the question right, is why a different time period? Why 5 years for savings account, 1 year for? Of course, you touched on that on payroll checks. You gave us information for that, but there are several other.
For example, specifically with money orders and I assume cashier's checks, it's 7 years. Deposits, another except payroll checks, it's 5 years. Why, if our law is so close now, as far as bank deposits goes, to the present proposed law, why change it from 7 to 5?
I was curious about 15 years on the traveler's checks too. It seemed weird.
Let me indicate why. you've all seen Carl Malden's ads on television telling you that American Express checks are really better than money. And people believe that. And whether that's the case or not, American Express has been able to document that about 97% of the traveler's checks that are outstanding at the end of 10 years will be cashed before 15 years. And people are pulling them out of safe deposit boxes and using them years and years later. What would happen is...
That's how they make big money.
Yeah. Now the drafting committee, and they spent a lot of money advertising to encourage you to do this. The drafting committee looked very carefully at the 15-year time period because it was in prior unclaimed property acts and received evidence from American Express Corporation, and everyone was satisfied that you just have a revolving door and that the state's cost of administering the return of the property between the 10th year and the 15th year would exceed the float that would come from having taken the property from American Express. So there was nothing to be gained at all, and in fact, it looked like there could be a loss. That's the reason why traveler's checks are at 15 years. Now, money orders are at 7 years. This was a result of a compromise. The money order industry came in and said, look, basically, we're in the business of trying to get the float, and we price our transaction based out on the fact that we have the use of this money, and that our charges generally are substantially diminished because we know we're going to hold a certain percentage of the property for a long period of time. And American Express came in and they testified that if the time period were reduced from 7 years to 5 years, it would take away the profit on the transaction. They accordingly would have to increase the issuance cost. But there was a trade-off that they entered into at this time. There's a provision in there that they can't service charge those money orders. There was a couple of companies, it was very insidious practice, whereby they would attempt to service charge an outstanding money order when in fact they were telling us that's what they bargained for. They wanted it to stay outstanding. And accordingly, there was a provision that went in there. Now, on cashier's checks and certified checks is a different time period. And the reason for this is that nobody, a certified check is merely a freezing of the bank account of a specific amount of money. If that hasn't come in relatively few months, there's very few people who are walking around with cashier's check or certified checks in their pocket using it the way Carl Malden would recommend. And the same thing is true for cashier's checks. So there's some logic here to what the time periods are. There is a reason for adopting the five-year time period. And that reason is that by the shorter the time period, the more likely you are to find the missing owner. If states are looking at this bill as a revenue raiser, you're much better off leaving long time periods because then nobody comes forward because the trail has gotten too cold. When you have a payroll check that's 5 or 7 years old, you're never going to find the payee of that check, but you make it 1 year, you will, in an overwhelming percentage of the cases. So if your interest was not to return the property, what you do is you go for a long time period. And it's not a question. Nobody leaves a check sitting around like a payroll check for years and years unless they've forgotten about it. In fact, most people, who can afford to let a payroll check sit for a week, let alone a year? So our presumptions of abandonment, I think, are safe in this case. And the question, I think, is appropriate, but I hope there's a rational reason for the various time periods that have been adopted.
In the film that some of us saw during the lunchtime, there was an incident involving a young girl. The child was about age 9, and at birth or shortly thereafter, the mother had opened an account of about $50 in a particular case, with dreams that ultimately this would get enough interest, I think, to buy the child an automobile or something. It didn't seem too reasonable. But nonetheless, the principle is that if property is held so-and-so as trustee for so-and-so, a minor, is there any specific provision in the Act not to escheat that or turn it over to the state in such a short period of time? Because many times, parents or other friendly donors, relatives, will put money aside in a bank account for a considerable period of time for a child. And the child can't do anything, maybe too young to know what to do, and nobody is really intending to have this be abandoned, but to be available for that kid at age 18. And everybody knows it's in that bank. And in this particular circumstance, everybody and the mother and the child, as the child became of age, knew the money was in the bank. And then one day they went down there to see, draw out the money for a bike or something, and the money was, lo and behold, gone. But a specific provision where it's held, and the bank and everyone know it's held for so-and-so, a minor.
I think what happened in that case, the bank had service charged most of the account away. It was only because of the state's unclaimed property law that brought a halt to the service charges, got the name advertised in the paper, and the parents came forward, complained. In this case, the California controller, Ken Corey, personally went over to the bank and asked that reinstate the full amount of the principal balance of this account. The state unclaimed property laws prevent the amounts from being dissipated. Normally, when you have inactive accounts, there's going to be charges extracted from them, and people are unaware of those charges. And this preserves those accounts, otherwise they'd probably be gone.
I want to deal with the service charge separately, and several of us were concerned about that service charge. But assume for the purpose of discussion at this point, you're dealing with an account that's owned in trust for a minor, and that the institution does not have a service charge that will draw the account down. The thing I'm concerned about, Mr. Epstein, is that the bank, simply because of the operation of a statute like this, would be required, after a period of time, to turn that money over to the state. And then the family would come back, and the account would be gone and closed out. And either the family would at that point become too flustered to ask about it, or too disheartened, or the bank employee might not know where the money went, you know, or something like this. Are there any provisions to prevent, it's similar to the tolling of a statute of limitation because of minority. Here, a provision that this, if we know it's for a minor, that the money must remain at least until the age of majority in that institution.
Let me indicate how the law works, and then let's see whether this is sufficient. Number one, there must not have been an addition or a withdrawal from that account for 5 years. There must not have been any contact by the bank, which at the end of 5 years is required to send out a notification saying, this is to remind you, you have an account here. And the state law requires that it be transferred to the state for safekeeping. If we don't hear from you, please sign the enclosed postcard. It means that it came back undeliverable. It means that there was no other banking relationship here. There was no other checking your savings account, and no credit cards, and no loans. Then the account was advertised, and the person did not see their name in the paper, yet presumably they still live in the same area. Then finally, after all that has taken place, it's turned over to the state. The person walks into the bank. In every case I've seen, the bank keeps a record of whether they turned the account over, and the closed signature card would say transferred to the state under the unclaimed property law. Just stamp that on. And then somehow the bank employee didn't know to check that record, and the person didn't know to inquire, where's my property? I've never seen that one happen. And in fact, if after all of that, the property is turned over to the state, your law provides, since this property was interest-bearing, that you will pay interest to that missing owner to make them whole while you're holding the property. I think that your concern, while it's appropriate, it happens so infrequently. In one out of thousands of cases, the problem is, in order to identify that situation, how do you take care of the situation where the people moved away? And it's only because a friend is going to see the name advertised in the paper that they're going to get a hold of somebody who's now living in Seattle to remind them that they put $75 in a savings account for their daughter. That's a more likely situation. And if you try to protect against this obscure situation that comes up over once in a while, you're going to throw out all the bathwater and the baby and the tub and probably the rest of the house, and there isn't going to be anything left over. So I think even with your interest provision here, nobody can get harmed, and the bank would always send the person on.
Hey, one final question, Mr. Chairman. The other thing that concerned me, and I think that possibly the chairman here too, is the issue of the interest service charge. And in that particular actual case, the bank had a practice of charging a service charge on these, quote, abandoned accounts, which they apparently didn't charge on other accounts. And apparently, in some states, now such service charges are illegal, according to the film, anyway. Does your act make such service charges illegal?
No, the way the act's been drafted is, and incidentally, I don't know that this is widespread here in Alaska. In fact, based on conversations I had today, I think it may not be too extensive, but I didn't get a chance to get into this in any depth. What this act does is it codifies the common law, and I presume it's your common law and contractual law here in Alaska, and you can correct me. What it says is you have to have an agreement with the customer. If you're going to service charge the account, you enter into an agreement. And it does one little thing to prevent what's gone on in many places. What the banks used to do is they'd waive the agreement for the customers. So for the handful of customers that happened to remember they had an old account, they'd come in, they'd never know there was a service charge.
But when the state of California came to collect their property, there was $50 million of service charges deducted from savings accounts that were being turned over. Well, he'd waive it to the customer. And so in what was called the chutzpah decision, brazen unmitigated gall is the way the judge defined it. Judge Perlis down in Sacramento County said at a hearing on the case, it was established that this particular bank would always waive the service charge for the good customers. And Judge Perlis said, who could be a better customer than the state of California? And ordered that they return all the service charges. And right now they're holding hearings on this. The case has been pending for about 8 years now, and it looks like there could be as much as a $50 million judgment awarded.
Have any states, as part of their Unclaimed Property Act, outlawed such service charges?
No. Wait, I'll take it back. It's possible that a couple of states have done that. I'd have to check. What the statutory trend has been is just to ensure that there's an agreement with the customer so the customer knows what the bargain is and that there be disclosure of the amounts of the service charges. And then the marketplace will regulate what takes place and that the agreement not be a retroactive agreement. Sometimes what's happened is that there'll be a bylaw passed, posted in an obscure corner of the bank lobby, and of course the missing customers would never get notice of this. They're missing. And service charges have been imposed on that basis. Again, I want to emphasize, I have no reason to believe that that's the practice here in Alaska.
On these statutes that do the regulation, would it be possible when you're sending this stuff up to your copies?
Yeah, I'll give you some examples.
Yeah, I'd like that too.
Taylor?
What do we do to make certain that these institutions make a bona fide attempt to locate? And the reason I'm asking that is when I moved from Ketchikan up to Wrangell, I unknowingly left a couple $100 in my daughter's savings account. Five or something, I set it up. I get up to Wrangell, and I'm there 7-8 years, and one day out of the blue, I get this phone call from a clerk in the bank down in Ketchikan. Now, I'm banking with the same bank.
It's the branch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I get the call, and it says, we wanted to let you know that your daughter Tracy has this savings account, and it came up on the list. We were going to turn this over to the state and thought you might be interested. And I said, well, yeah, I'm interested. Why in the heck haven't I ever seen we didn't have a, she didn't say they didn't have a forwarding address, but of course they obviously did. I was in and out of the community all the time. Well, just incredible to me that they had allowed that to go on for that long with no attempt to contact me or send me a bank statement on it or anything else. And to me, it was just gross. There was no reason in the world that I know probably every person in each of those branch banks down there on a first name basis. Deal with them with 3 or 4 different accounts in 2 other branches of that same bank and institution. And yet, it was only because of our state law that I was ever given any notification of that. So
and I think the law was working because you got notified.
The law was working to the extent that after all that period of time I was notified. But what is there in this that will require, or who will be supervising those various entities to see to it that they actually do a good faith effort of following through with attempting to notify customers, because there's a lot of incentive not to notify.
I think that
both for the state and for the institution.
Let me point something out, because this is a two-way street. It is expensive monitoring inactive accounts for the purpose of then attempting to locate missing owners. Time you get somebody to go through all the telephone books and to use all the other resources, it could start running a bank $10, $15, $20 an account. So you want to be careful what the nature of the obligation is that you impose on the bank. Otherwise, you're going to increase their cost substantially. I have to turn around and charge you right back for it. So I think there's some harmonizing what the objectives are by the Act here. The situation you gave is that maybe it was somewhat belatedly, but they did get a hold of you. What this law requires is that they make a sincere effort to get an address for you and to send you a notification. Then the state is going to advertise and send out another notification. I don't think it's too much, though, to expect customers, when they move, to give a forwarding address to the bank and to get the record changed. And if the bank, if they don't do that, and the bank's got to start searching for people, there's a cost to that. And I'm not sure it's fair to impose it on the bank unless you give them the opportunity to reimburse themselves for it.
Well, in this instance, I transferred 7 different accounts out of that bank to their other branch bank and had neglected to transfer that one.
They darn well knew
where I was.
And you should have been getting notifications of that.
And I hadn't. We'd moved in January, and at the end of the, they sent out one statement a year on those that little savings account. And as a consequence, when they went to send it out, they sent it the old address down there, and I never saw it, and it came back bouncing back to me.
I hope this is not a representative situation, because lots of times, most banks, when they're given a new address, of course, will get into their records. And this law does something here. It now makes it clear that you check the other relationships to see if the person...
I like that aspect.
Yeah, and I think that'll
I've
keep
got another question, though, for you. I think it kind of hits at the core of this lost people. I've never signed up on a bank account that I didn't have to give my Social Security number. Never bought any stock I didn't have to do that. Almost everything I do that involves money, I have to have a Social Security number someplace on it. Why in the world are we trying to keep track of people's properties through the transient changes of address that we all go through? In my district, I know that in a 2-year period, there'll be as much as a 30% turnover on addresses. You can take a mailing list as an example, and 2 years later, you're lucky if 30% of them aren't missing from those addresses. Mm-hmm. Now, as a consequence, why in the world can't we utilize a Social Security numbering system for that?
It's being done. Right now, on the bank accounts, the AG's office is using that information to make a link up through vital statistics. I believe they use it on the driver's license. And they're using it on your permanent fund. And on big accounts, you'll find states will contact the Social Security Administration, pay them $2, and ask them to forward a letter saying, please contact the state of such and such in order to claim your property. Now, they will not disclose the location of the person, but they'll forward a letter. And let me point something out that's going on, because it's fascinating.
I just didn't know that was available.
I didn't know that was available.
Does that have to be in the law?
No. And it'll be administered that way. The states are making sincere efforts to return property. In Massachusetts now, they have this wonderful program whereby they take their computer out to shopping malls, and people can come up and give their name, and they're finding 1 out of every 5 persons has got property coming. The state treasurer of Iowa has got a weekly radio show, half-an-hour radio show, Friday morning on WHO. It's a 50,000 clear watt station. Goes all the way down to New Orleans. He gets on there, he reads the names of missing owners of property, tells anecdotes. He's already returned about $400,000 of property. A lot of states work very close with their legislators in these programs, because they find the district offices of the legislators have sometimes have good access to who's in the district, and they will do a cut by zip code off the computer, send it regularly out to the office, and have your staffs or yourselves go through it and see if there's any property there that can be claimed. You can put it in your and in the libraries around there, perhaps the city hall, post these lists.
He
could, yeah. the weeklies love to carry the names of missing owners of property. It's a real good circulation gimmick. If you work closely
with the administrators of the program, I think you can come up with something that'll really get a good return. And there's still going to be enough property left over for your wherever you're going to place it, that everybody comes out ahead.
But at least there is a good coordination ongoing now, utilizing Social Security numbers for purposes of locating people for that purpose.
In place right now.
Well, that's good. Appreciate
that. Stephanie, let me divert for a second. How long are you going to be in town?
Unfortunately, I have to leave today at 6:30.
Today at 6:30.
Unless I get run out sooner.
Yeah. No, I was hoping you were going to go a little longer. We can always get hold of you by telephone.
Right. And invite me back up in the middle of summer. I'll be here.
With the King Salmon running.
Yeah.
Well, this is a very attractive bill.
Leave a list of all my relatives with you.
This is a very attractive bill for less than $200,000 of expense to get back, as estimated by the Division of Revenue, or Department of Revenue, we get back $2 million. So
I think that's correct.
So it's
better than the average investment.
Yes, I think so. In fact, I was thinking, if we fail to do it, maybe some private entrepreneur will come in and offer to do it for us for a cut of it.
Then we may invest in gold again.
I would like to point something out. There's a couple of provisions of the bill that are fairly technical that I've discussed with the Attorney General's office, and they might want to recommend that there be a little fine-tuning. I didn't intend to open it up right now, but in order to maximize the amount of property you're going to get, I'm probably going to recommend they make a couple of changes, and I would appreciate your giving them some consideration, because the one thing that we found is if you have a little ambiguity in the Act, and then everybody is unable to know what their obligations are, and a program can get frozen, and you have to end up going to the courts to be told what could have been put in the Act to begin with. So I'm going to be talking with the AG's office and suggest some language to them, and I would hope you would consider it, because I'm a little worried about a couple of these provisions, that they would just create chaos where it could be taken care of right away. Nothing terribly significant, technical kinds of things.
Okay, yeah, please, we will work with the AG's office. We'll continue questioning right after the time the bell rings, 3 o'clock, but I just want to say, I'm going to appoint a subcommittee right now made up of myself and Representative Grunberg, and we'll work with the Attorney General's office and come back with the committee says to. Taylor, I think you were next. Mr. Pedro, were you asking me?
No.
Just kind of a technical question. What happens when, say, you go into a safe deposit box and you find 20 gold coins? Now they're monetary, or gold nuggets. That would not be uncommon in this state, because people save those and accumulate them up here and kind of cherish it.
Auction.
State, there's a procedure. You hold them for a while, see if the owner will come forward, and then after that, the state can auction off the property.
Okay, now what about interest rates? We've had interest rates over the last several years that have fluctuated all over the place. Now we stretch this program for 60 years, and the state is required to pay interest that is due back to that party.
Oh, let me point out, I should have done this before. The interest automatically cuts out after 10 years, otherwise you could have an enormous liability. Now, the interest is only paid on property that was originally interest-bearing, because in other words, you're going to make the person whole. The state has the benefit of the use. For the handful of people who come forward, they'll get all their property. But in no event will the interest go past 10 years.
There had to be a cutoff someplace.
Yeah, it's in the law.
The
debt, terrible.
The potential liability would just continue to grow and grow and grow.
Sure, at 7%, doesn't it double at 14 years?
Well, it doubles in less than 12. 6% it doubles at 12.
Has the organized bar in any of the states had any input or any concern, aside from, of course, the fact this is a uniform act in the ABA? But I know it's not uncommon for lawyers in their trust accounts to find money remaining there after a considerable period of time.
There's been some law firms have found this a useful tool to unload all the old records. And yeah, if it's money held in the ordinary course of business, so it doesn't apply to your personal checking account, so you send out a check, it doesn't go cash, it's not subject to the state unclaimed property law. If it's in the course of a business, then in that case you can report it over and just wash your hands of the whole situation and let the state take care of it. And I've seen some law firms that had some modest amounts of turnover. If it's true you're acting as a trustee, there could be substantial amounts. And the only way, this is a quick way to relieve yourself of an obligation without having to, in many cases, you'd have to file a petition with the court where it's not otherwise required, and here you get a relief from liability by using this law. It's a real shortcut. And there, it used to be some of the institutions opposed these laws several years ago. Now they're seeing these as useful tools to solve some of their problems.
We have a few more minutes. We have Ms. Green, I think, has another question like this.
I just want to follow up on a question that Representative Hunter asked in terms of what was sufficient to prevent abandonment in regard to bank deposits. I think I heard you say that if the bank or institution or credit union were to send out a postcard saying you're informing the owner that your account will be forfeited if you don't hear from
Not forfeited. Will be put in safekeeping.
Yeah, safekeeping. And the card does not come back, addressee unknown, that is sufficient.
No.
Okay, that's
right. The person has to sign the postcard saying, I'm aware I have an account. This goes on all over the country. They sign a postcard that says, yes, I'm aware I have an account. Please let it remain.
So if they don't sign it, then, in fact, that there hasn't been sufficient contact.
And if they have no other relationship with the bank, and if they don't respond to any phone inquiry, right, I mean, that person's gone. There will be, let me point out, every once in a while, out of thousands of cases, there will be an occasional one where the person's there, they don't open up their mail. But they're not going to be harmed because the state's going to pay interest. And normally, there's such a concern that this is going to happen that what you hear is that in every case, a person is somehow going to lose their savings account when it only happens inadvertently in one out of a thousand cases. And let me tell you why you can be sure of this. In over half the states, these programs are run by elected officials. There's no way that they would have this law in place if they were getting telephone calls from people objecting to the law. In fact, what they're getting is widespread publicity on how they're returning property, and they're hearing nothing but compliments from people who said, I had no idea I had this account, or I didn't know that Aunt Jenny had this account. We already probated her estate. And that's what's going on, and you shouldn't be concerned with the extraordinary case that arises where the person has never opened their mail. They're not going to lose anything anyway. What will happen is they'll wander in, they'll say your account's with the state will write them out a check, including the interest with your account, and they'll be right back in the same position they were in. And that happens in a minimal number of cases. And the only way to get all the property that's truly lost is to use the criteria that's been set up this way.
Gurney raised an awfully good question there, and I think Mr. Bloomberg had a suggestion earlier about that. On the card, we could put in four categories where they could check on. Very similar to the adoption bill.
Sure. Go ahead, try and do that.
Do not write me again.
Yeah, the credit unions have raised this question in a number of states, and the state administrators have tried to work very closely with the credit unions. In fact, a former unclaimed property administrator, Ed Callahan of Illinois, became the chairman of the National Credit Union Administration. So while he was in there, they put in a lot of rules that were really well designed to take care of unclaimed property matters. In the case of the membership fee, the question that really arises, if you can't find the person anymore, and if they can't exercise the rights to which they're entitled as a member, is there really going to be a serious harm suffered by somebody who can get no privileges that are associated with that fee? Most of the credit unions, upon examining that and checking to see really can they find these people, have concluded that in this case there isn't going to be a substantial harm suffered by the person because they're probably unaware that they're still a member. And I saw something today that really startled me. One of your credit unions reported to the Attorney General's office $190,000 in unclaimed credit union accounts. It's the second largest report I've ever seen from a credit union in the United States. And what it shows is probably people who were working up here before were using the credit union for their savings account, and they're long gone. And you need to make some real effort to try and round these people up. And in the absence of this law, those people would never know about their property. And the amounts were $10, $15, occasionally were several thousand, but they're smaller amounts generally.
In the case of the credit union, though, with $5 fee, they would send out the return postcard. And I what I'm hearing you say is in 999 pieces out of 1,000, they'll get the signed card back saying, yes, I'm still here, yes, I want to still be a member of the
group. If the person's there.
Yeah, if they're there. And if they're not, then you don't, then it's
undeliverable. They're long gone. That's when it should be turned
over.
Okay, are there further questions? Stripson, we're very indebted to you for coming up here and presenting this. I
loved it. Thank you very much. Invite me again, will you please?
Well, I think maybe we will. You may have made us a couple of $1 million a year. Surely we can find some way to
get any more ideas, come back with
them. Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Yeah, we can put my color contact here.
Did you just finish your Cotton's bill before I got here?
Make way.
Cotton's bill?
No.
No, I have not scheduled that over. I forgot about it, too. I'll schedule over tomorrow, and then we'll get together, and
okay.
I'll let you know. Yeah. I don't know what that bill is.
All right.
Also, for the record, I should say, too, that Mr. Clarkson is ill, and that's the reason he's not here. That should be on the record. Okay, we stand adjourned.
Yeah, he did that.
I mean, he was still too grumpy.